there's definitely times for lying face down on the floor and crying in the kitchen, which I did. But there's also, you know, there is this sense of freedom that comes, you know, however your divorce started. At some stage, I think everyone gets to the stage where suddenly you're like, I'm free.
Hello, you are listening to the Capsule in Conversation podcast. I'm Natalie Anderson, and today I'm joined by award-winning actress, comedian, and creator of the Divorce Social podcast, Samantha Baines, to talk finding the funny, living with hearing loss, and love post-divorce. So sit back, relax, and get ready to join us in our conversation. Hello all, I hope you're all well. Can you believe it's just over a month to Christmas? I think it might be time to get the decks and the sparkles out. Too soon? Never. Well, bringing a dose of sparkle to our podcast today is a woman who's been lighting up the stage and the screen throughout her illustrious career. As an actress, she's appeared in The Crown, Call the Midwife, and A Royal Night Out. Whilst on stage, she played the original MC in Channing Tatum's Magic Mike Live at London's Hippodrome. As a comedian, she's picked up numerous awards, including the What the Frock Best Newcomer Award, and was named a finalist in the Funny Women Awards just 1 year into her stand-up career. She's also an established author with her books Harriet vs. the Galaxy and The Night the Moon Went Out, receiving critical acclaim as must-read books for children, with her new book, Living with Hearing Loss and Deafness, scheduled for a release next year. She's also the creator and host of the hugely successful and again award-winning podcast, The Divorce Social, whilst also being an ambassador for the Royal Institute for Deaf People. She is pretty amazing, and she's here with me now. It's the wonderful Samantha Baines. Hi.
Hi. What an introduction. Thanks.
No, thank you so much for being with me. As I just said then, what a list of achievements. I mean, I don't know how we're going to cover it all, but we'll try. Have you always enjoyed like doing lots of different things?
Yes. People always say to me, you do so much. And I guess I do, but I find it hard to relax, and I'm working on it, but I like keeping busy, and also I like doing different things. And you know, when I started out as an actor, it was very much like prepare your craft and then wait to be called on to do it. And I sort of couldn't get on board with that, so I prepared my craft and then I tried to work out ways that I could express myself while waiting for a call for an audition.
It is really tough, that, isn't it? I mean, it really drives me mad. You're so put into a box, especially when you're young and you're starting out, and it's like, stay in your lane. You know what side of the industry you're going to be in. You know, are you a straight actor? Are you a musical theatre? Are you, you know, a comedian? What are you doing? And I was always of the mindset, like, in America, it seems very different. They want you to be everything in America. But in the UK, it's very much, isn't it, stay in your lane.
I sort of felt like I didn't have a lane to stay in. So when I graduated from drama school, I was very much the like, well, you're sort of an all-rounder. You could play most things. But I think sometimes for getting auditions, that's quite hard, because if no one knows who you are and what you do, then they don't sort of know where to put you in to audition you. And boxes obviously can be really annoying and you want to break free, but initially boxes can be quite useful because it gets your foot in the door. And so I felt a bit like, well, what am I? What sort of things do I do? So I guess I was, and still am, striving to find what those things are and kind of experiment, and for myself as much as the industry, you know, trying to put me in boxes.
What would you say was the moment that kind of you felt like, actually, no, I know what's working for me and I know kind of where I'm going with this now? Was it in the comedy circuit? Was it acting?
It comes and goes. I think knowing my worth took a long time in the industry, in a career perspective, and also in my life. I feel like it took a divorce for me to and then the healing process of that for me to know my worth as like a partner and a human and, you know, in the world and in my non-career side of things. And then knowing my worth in the career is very hard because you go through periods where you do a lot and you're kind of feel in demand and you're like, oh, this is it. I've made it. You know, this is what everyone's always been talking about. The only way is up. And then you feel sort of really full of yourself. And then after that, you have a quiet period of time and you're like, oh, wait a minute, this is,
I'm not the bee's knees.
Yeah, this isn't how I thought things would go. So you sort of know your worth and then lose it again. You have to find it again. I think for me, weirdly, writing books has been an interesting shift for me, because it's, you know, if you go to a party and someone says, what do you do? And you say, you're an actor. It's like that Notting Hill moment. You know, they don't really take you seriously, or they'll be like, oh, okay, what have you been in? Or what's your other job? And with a comedian, you know, it's similar, that unless you've been on live at the Apollo, they don't sort of see you as a proper comedian. And for me, you know, I don't do stand up anymore, but I did stand up for many years. But I think it was like 7 or 8 years. And when I was doing that, I loved it and I enjoyed it. But for me, like going on live at the Apollo was never the route that, you know, my career in my mind was going to go. So, you know, you're judged on these things and then you're not taken seriously in that person at the party's head because you haven't done the thing that they think of as, oh, that's a comedian. And actually, when I wrote my first book, I felt like a complete sort of novice and outside. It was like this whole new world. I didn't understand it. And even though my book came out and it was like available, you know, in bookshops, I felt like I'd somehow convinced some people to publish a book and it had happened by accident and they didn't really know what they'd done. Like I'd like brainwash them or hypnotize them. And someone, you know, that total imposter syndrome, like, someone was going to turn around and be like, hang on, we've made a huge mistake. And it wasn't until I started calling myself an author, you know, which I thought, oh, I'm allowed to do now because I have a book out. And the reaction at parties, I know this is a weird way to define your life.
No, I love this.
But when you say you're an author, the reaction is so different to saying any of my other careers. The reaction to author is like, wow, you're a real person who's done stuff. And all of a sudden I was getting this reaction from strangers, people in the industry, you know, even children when I'd go in and do book talks, they were like, wow, you're an author. And I just felt like I never had this response to what I did before. And it made me feel very proud of what I'd done. And then I managed to sort of take that into all of my other things. But yeah, weirdly, it was people reacting to me being an author at parties that helped me find my worth.
This episode of The Capsule in Conversation is brought to you by Harrogate Springwater. Famous for its waters since 1571, Harrogate is Britain's premium natural source water. Don't you think it's that thing of being proper? Like, oh, you've got an education, like, you know, that old fashioned kind of attitude. And I think, you know, as we kind of touch on, I don't think people really understand a lot of the acting, kind of presenting, comedy side of things. They see a lot of glamour, but they don't really see like the hard graft that goes into it. And especially when you're creating your own stuff. I mean, comedy, that is such a hard avenue. And I wanted to ask, you know, how do you create funny? Because people seem to think it's really easy. And actually, to get a joke to land properly, it's very difficult. And to choose what is funny to your audience, what is the process of that?
I think it's funny because people always say comedy is so hard. And having done quite a few things, as we mentioned, I would say it's just as hard as all the others. It's just a different skill. So I think the thing about being an author is it's not seen as glamorous, so maybe it's more serious. Whereas acting, they're like, oh, you just swan up and say some lines and then go to parties. And comedy, you just turn up and then you're funny with a microphone. And actually, in all of those avenues, there's so much work that goes into it, you know. And with comedy, I think it taught me a lot about writing and editing. And you know, there is this kind of misconception among some people that in comedy you sort of just turn up and you're just naturally funny. And some comedians you meet are just naturally funny all the time and they come out with, you know, one-liners off the top of their heads. But even they hone their material and write it down and edit it and sometimes work with other writers before they go on stage and present it. And then other comedians you'll meet in real life and they're just very like calm and quiet and quite serious. You know, who you are as an individual, because people are always like, I'm the funny person in the office. Great. That doesn't mean you won't be a good comedian, but it doesn't mean you will be a good comedian, because so much of it is, it's performance technique. And that's different to acting, because you're face to face with an audience. Unless you're playing a character, you're you, but you're still having to get your personality across quite quickly, because audiences will judge you in you know, that first minute of you speaking. And so getting your personality across, your point of view, where you're coming from, performing your jokes, because you can write incredible jokes, but then lose it all in the delivery and performance. You know, there's so many different styles of comedy, and a lot of, you know, when you start out as a stand-up is finding your style. And it might not always be the comedy that you love, because I loved like really intelligent comedy. And I was like, oh my God, I'm basically going to be like a one woman, like Monty Python, Blackadder, like just like really clever and witty. And people would be like, oh my God, she's so amazing. I can't believe she has all this knowledge, but she's made it humorous. And then actually I realized that I'm chatty. Comedy only worked for me when I was like me and chatty, and I was trying to be clever, and then that in itself was quite funny. And so, you know, you find out your own path of like how that works for you, performance and writing wise. And it's a real finding your voice.
And I imagine like in that comedy circuit kind of thing, you know, you are building up, you talk about self-worth. I mean, being heckled and then having that kind of inner strength to push past that, you know, it's quite a vulnerable place to be, and not letting the heckling or the, you know, having a go at you kind of thing knock your confidence. I mean, that must as well also kind of make you a little bit more robust for other areas in life.
Hecklers don't happen that often. And when they do happen, you know, you're on stage with a light on you, with a microphone. So you're in a position of power, and the heckler is sitting in the dark shouting something for their friends. Obviously, you have to tell him off or make a joke or whatever. And that is something that you develop over time. You know, it's a bit like being a teacher, and if one of your students shouts out, you know, you're still the one in control of the room. What I found knocked my confidence more was the green room before you go on stage with other comedians. And obviously, you know, there are so many brilliant female comedians out there, and representation is getting better. But on the comedy circuit and the gigging circuit, representation isn't always there. And, you know, when I started out, I was the only woman on a bill. So I was in a green room with, you know, maybe five guys, who were usually much older than me, because, you know, I started out when I was in my early 20s. You know, they might know each other, because there's always four or five of them on a bill together, so they probably see each other more than I would see my fellow female comedians. It's like your first day at school every time you go into a green room, unless you know, further it down the line in your career, when you've got a gig and you know everyone on the bill and they're all nice people, it's like, oh my gosh, what joy.
Now, having, like you said, you know, that imposter syndrome, and then getting to a place now where you do have, you know, two incredible books out, already a third one planned for next year. And as you were saying about representation, both of your books at the minute, and obviously the future one that's coming out, deal with hearing loss, which is something for you that you experienced really early on in life, but didn't kind of get a diagnosis till much later. I mean, talk to me about that experience, you know, growing up, feeling like, you know, you had glue ear, all these different hearing elements that were going on with you, and how that's impacted you kind of growing up and getting into the industry.
I only got my hearing loss diagnosis, and that is what they call it. The audiologist, they say you have hearing loss. Now I would say I'm deaf and I'm part of the deaf community, but I got my hearing loss diagnosis when I was, I think, like 29. I had glue ear when I was younger, and I had grommets put in, which is to help glue ear. So it's like an operation. And a grommet is just a small plastic tube that they put in your eardrum to drain the glue ear, because the glue ear is basically fluid on your ear, and it's fairly common in children. But I didn't really ever understand what that was, and I thought when they'd put grommets in, I was like, oh, I've got hearing aids in my ear. Even though, and it, honestly, I was like in my late 20s when I discovered that grommets were literally just a small plastic tube. So I would always hear this high-pitched beeping noise from maybe like 12 years old. And I'd be like, that's my grommets, because I thought they were like hearing aids. So I was like, that's just them, you know, beeping every so often. And it took me until my hearing loss diagnosis to find out that that was tinnitus. And that was only because I had another type of tinnitus, which I call my spider tinnitus, which was brought on by loud noises. It actually started at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival while Felicity Ward was DJing. Nothing against Felicity Ward's DJing, because she was brilliant and is a brilliant DJ. But I was standing really close to like the speakers, and then I started to hear this like scrabbling noise in my ear when it was particularly loud. And so obviously I was like, oh my God, there's a spider living in my ear. And it's just really upset that there's loud noise. And then when I got home from Edinburgh, I went to the GP. I mean, bless, I have anxiety, like proper anxiety. I take medication for it. And so she was very used to me by this stage. And I was like, hello, there might be an animal living in my ear. She was like, okay, sure, let's have a look. And there wasn't. She said, let's send you for a hearing test just to check. And that was when I discovered I had hearing loss and I needed a hearing aid in one ear. I have hearing loss in both ears, but it's worse on one side. And that's where I have the hearing aid. And then it was only through that process that I discovered I had two different types of tinnitus. RNID, the charity I'm ambassador for, say it takes on average 10 years to notice the signs of hearing loss and deafness and do anything about them. And I definitely know that there were things I couldn't hear or made excuses for not hearing when I was growing up. And then that really came to a head, I would say, like in my early 20s, and especially gigging, because it's such a loud background noise. And that is one of the reasons I've stopped doing live stand-up now. You know, obviously I do lots of other things. So, but it is a very overwhelming sound environment. And even though I have hearing loss and I'm deaf, I also have something called sound sensitivity. So the sounds that I can hear, if they're of a particular pitch, or sometimes just a really small sound, you know, like when you're in a restaurant and they start grinding coffee beans in the coffee machine. So if someone's talking to me in front of me and that's happening, even if it's quite far away, it's like my hearing just singles in on that noise. And it's almost like that noise is painful.
Yeah.
And that's a thing that, you know, people who don't have hearing loss have, and people with hearing loss have. So environments with lots of sound and lots of background noise can be really overwhelming. And I was finding that with the comedy circuit, you know, with comedy venues quite often have seating and then maybe a bar in the background. Mm. So there's clinking of glasses and people ordering drinks. There's also people sitting down waiting for the gig to start, chatting to their friends. And then I'd be backstage, and sometimes backstage is only separated by like a thin wall or a curtain. And then the people in the green room are all talking to each other, and then the person who runs the gig comes over and starts talking to you. And so there was a lot of noise going on. And when I was actually on stage talking into the microphone, it was fine because yeah. all I had to hear was my own voice and the odd heckler. You know, it was actually all the kind of before and after. And then even like getting the train home, and then the train's really noisy and you've already been in this noisy environment. And deaf people and people with hearing loss will know that there's something called concentration fatigue.
Mm.
And sound fatigue and listening fatigue, it's called. And that is basically, you know, when there are things you can't hear, and you're trying to hear, so you're in a hearing environment like a comedy gig that doesn't have, you know, BSL signing or captioning, you're concentrating so hard on hearing that it takes all of your attention and all of your energy. So I'd find that after gigs, I'd need to sleep for like a full day, and
yeah.
I wouldn't be able to do stuff like an acting job the next day. Or I mean, I would, and then I'd be knackered, but you know, or write a book or write more material. And it was really kind of taking its toll on me. And I think one of the things I always try and say about my deafness is that it doesn't hold me back.
Yeah.
I love being deaf, and I love my hearing aid, and I love, you know, what it's brought to my life, being the deaf community, being writing books with deaf protagonists and what that means for young deaf children. And but a lot of the time it's hearing environments and a hearing society that holds us back or causes us extra fatigue or, you know, whatever it is. And for me, with that, the stand-up was just, even though I love performing,
yeah,
it was making my life more difficult. So I did stop doing that, but I can perform in other ways. And I know I have privilege, you know, to be able to do that.
Out of interest, and, you know, I might be completely wrong here, but, you know, obviously you said that you suffer with anxiety. Because you weren't given a diagnosis up until that point and being exposed to like those kind of environments, you know, the stimulation that you would have gone through, and also kind of the, like you say, if you're kind of on high alert because you can hear something so sensitively, are the two interlinked by any chance at all?
Very possibly. So my new book that I'm almost finished,
yes,
at the moment, which is out on the 27th of April 2023 and is currently available to pre-order, is called Living with Hearing Loss and Deafness, A Guide to Owning It and Loving It. I'm trying to compile together facts and figures, information, but also, you know, personal stories from myself. And I've interviewed a lot of other deaf people and BSL users who are deaf and people who wear hearing aids, but maybe don't like to call themselves deaf. And, you know, so lots of different people from different experiences, and, you know, also the Black deaf community and the LGBTQ plus deaf community. And I've also been speaking to experts and looking into all of that, and I
yeah.
discovered, which I didn't know before, is that deaf people and also disabled people are, it's something like 2.75, but let's say twice as likely to experience mental health conditions or poor mental health than people who aren't deaf or who aren't disabled. And that can go up to like four times more likely. But yeah, a lot of it is, I didn't know what was going on with me. I felt very alone and different. And, you know, when I got my hearing loss diagnosis, I definitely felt very othered. And I was 29. Like, I felt like, oh, people aren't deaf at 29. You know, this is something that only people with grey hair and Werther's Originals in their pockets experience. And actually, now I know that is not true. And there's a whole incredible community of deaf people of all ages. But at that time, I just felt so othered and different and alone. And how am I going to get through this? I've got no support. Where do I look for support? And, you know, and this is part of the reason I've written the book, is because this is the book I looked for. But all of that obviously impacts your mental health. And then day to day, you know, if I know I'm going into a loud environment like a party, and, you know, we met at the Institutional Women's Podcast Awards, which was brilliant, but I know that that is going to be a loud, overwhelming sound environment for me. And I know there's going to be lots of people there talking. I'm going to be meeting new people because I lip read as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be meeting new people. I'm not going to know their lip patterns. You know, when you meet someone new and if they've got an accent like you do,
yeah,
you know, sometimes people move their mouths differently with different accents, even regional accents in the UK. So you're like zoning in and then learning to kind of lip read that individual person, as well as trying to hear and trying to not be distracted by background noise with my sound sensitivity. So I know that that's going to be a hugely overwhelming environment. So, you know, I can be anxious before I go out into an environment like that. And I'm not anxious because people are like, oh my God, you're so confident. What? You're a trained actor. How can you be anxious? I'm not anxious because of me.
Yeah.
I'm like, I know I'm awesome. And I'm really excited that all these people get to meet me. Yay there. But I know I'll meet incredible people and like learn from them through the discussions. And we had a great chat.
Yeah.
But I am nervous and anxious because I know it's going to be a lot
and tough on your body as well, you know, like your heartbeat, your adrenaline's going because your body's having to work so hard to kind of, as you say, be present and in the room, and it's not built for kind of your experience, so to speak. It's like, you know, one of the most incredible moments last year was on Strictly with Rose, which was just incredible and a real like standout moment, I think, for actually A, that being deaf does not hold you back in any way. Like there's the rich talent out there. She was incredible. But also just that moment where the music stopped and what her experience was to show us back, to reflect that, I thought was incredible. And it was the same in Coda, the film, where the father of the family, and you know, he can't hear and his daughter wants to sing, and when she was singing the song to him, and oh my God, it makes me want to cry now, just the power of the emotion in her face, and that's what he was reading for how beautiful she was singing. And that representation, getting out there, is so important, isn't it? And I imagine that that's kind of why you're championing so much of the work that you do.
Well, I hadn't seen growing up deaf representation. You know, I think the first deaf person I saw in TV or film or books was Hugh Grant's brother in Four Weddings and a Funeral. And I was like, oh my God, this is so exciting. I've never seen someone using sign language on screen other than when they're the interpreter and they're really small in the corner. But representation is so, so important. And also depth and scope of representation, because Rose did so much on Strictly, and now she did this incredible speech at the Edinburgh TV Festival recently and talked about the burden of representation as well, because you know, obviously I don't want to talk for her, and anyone should go and watch her speech because it's like the whole thing is incredible. But you know, as a deaf person in the public eye, there's irony here because I'm also, you know, promoting being deaf in the public eye, and I know that that gets me work because I'm deaf and I want to provide representation. But also, you know, with people like Rose, there becomes a burden on them to be the deaf person in the public eye and to speak for everyone and to change the world. And to, and actually, you know, she even says in her speech, you know, there needs to be more representation, there needs to be more people. And she talks about, you know, projects being greenlit with her attached. And then if she's not attached, the project won't happen. And that, you know, she doesn't want that to happen, but she can't do everything. And representation is so important. And with films like Coda, you know, winning Best Picture at the Oscars, and I got to interview the cast of Coda and the director and talking about the process and you know, their accessibility behind the scenes, and the crew all learned sign language and they were communicating using sign language, which is actually amazing and so useful on a film set, because quite often you're far away and instead of shouting, you can just sign. But also in the deaf community, you know, there has been criticism of Coda because of the way it portrays the deaf family with the CODA. So CODA stands for Child of Deaf Adult.
Yeah.
In the film, you know, she seems to kind of resent her family because she constantly has to interpret for them. And the problem here is this is one story in a film, which is fictional. And so we can enjoy the film and it can also raise representation, which is great. But because this is one of the only films, it's like, well, now this is the only representation of a CODA in a deaf family. And it doesn't speak for all deaf families and all CODAs who you might not resent their deaf family and might not think their deaf family, you know, holds them back. But I think at the heart, representation is amazing. And we just need more of it. And, you know, that's why I write children's books with deaf main characters. And it's not that I want to be the only one. I definitely want more deaf authors to write them. And, you know, my new book is nonfiction and is, and I've written it because I couldn't find this book with information, but also chatty bits and actual experiences from real people. But I don't want to be the only book out there. I want everyone to, you know, and I don't use BSL as my first language. I'm learning it, but I didn't have access to it when I was growing up. You know, I'd love someone to write a book who uses BSL as their first language and does it from their perspective, because I've interviewed people in my book, but that's not my experience. So I just think we just need more representation. And you're right, it is so important.
You know, obviously we're making progress, but we just need to keep moving in the right direction, really. You know, and obviously you were talking about doing other things that aren't kind of centered around your deafness, when one of those things is the Divorce Social podcast, you know, I mean, like, which is amazing. And, you know, has come from your own personal experience, has been hugely successful. Awards, you know, as we said before, you know, we met at the International Women's Podcast Award. You'd won for the Moment of Touch Honesty. You'd also taken, we'll take in bronze in the 2022, you know, podcast awards. But you know, it was amazing to obviously to have been there and to have won. So just tell me a bit more about kind of your experience of divorce and this whole community that you've created, which is amazing.
It's funny, I've sort of become, from not knowing I was going to get divorced or not knowing I was going to need a hearing aid, I've sort of become an accidental, like, deaf and divorce influencer, which is very niche. I got divorced. We separated at the end of 2018.
Yeah.
Or 2019. I don't know, around then, before the pandemic. So I was sort of thrust into this new world and I was, you know, still early 30s. I'm 35 now. So it was very interesting because a lot of people didn't assume that I'd be married. They were like, oh, you're young to be married. And then all of a sudden I was also divorced. We were together for nearly a decade, but we were only married for a year and a half. And again, I just felt different and weird and like, no one gets divorced at my age. What's going on? And none of my peers were, you know, my friends and colleagues from school or whatever were getting divorced. And I wanted to talk to people about it. And my parents had separated, but then my dad had died. So they'd never actually got divorced. So there wasn't really anyone I could turn to be like, what's going on with this? Like, how do I... should I feel like this? Am I normal? What's going on? Normal in inverted commas. Who's normal?
Yeah.
But so I was in Magic Mike Live at the time and I was getting divorced and, you know, emceeing this show, which was like...
which I've seen.
Sexual, you know, and I was talking on stage to women about like allowing ourselves to feel sexy and sexual and own our sexuality and talking about consent and, you know, enjoy masturbating and all of that stuff. And then at the same time, I was, you know, trying to heal my heart and body and going through this stuff. And I had the idea for a podcast very selfishly because I just wanted to talk to someone else who was going through what I was going through to be like, do you do this too?
Yeah.
You cried face down on the floor? Or is it just me? And I remember people in the industry said to me, oh my God, who's going to want to listen to two women complaining about their exes and their divorce? And so for a long time, I put it off. And then I was like, do you know what? I'm just going to do it. And I can just do like a series. So yeah, I did the first series. We started with Sarah Millican because in the world of comedy, some female comedians like me have been divorced. And Sarah Millican was always a person that people had gone to for advice and had been really lovely to like other divorced people in the industry. So I thought, well, she's my first point of call. And then I just did this series where I just chatted to people and basically asked their advice and listened to their stories. And then people did listen and did want to hear it. And I think the response that I got to that first series was a big shock, you know, because I started it in lockdown and I'm talking to you from my spare room now, which I call my office.
Yes.
And so I recorded the whole thing from my office during lockdown on the, you know, online with people, just having chats. I got an editor friend of mine to edit it because I wanted it to sound nice. And then I sort of just put it out into the world. I mean, luckily, this is another side of me we haven't covered, but I own a social media marketing company that I set up.
Just to add to all the other things.
Sure, that I set up when I left drama school and I was working in an art gallery doing marketing, as you do. And now it's like a company and I have a whole team of amazing people. It's called Penguin in the Room. So luckily, I had that team of people sort of to ask advice from. But I just created my own logo, you know, stuck it all up, did it all myself. And the emails I started getting from people and the messages of just, you know, people in the thick of divorce or about to go through or thinking of going through it and dealing with that turmoil and, you know, breadth of experience, because you go through all of the emotions that I was going through and that it meant something to them. And then I was like, well, I'm going to have to do another series. Off
you're
we go.
Have to.
and then we're sort of two and a bit years on and it's, yeah, 1-2 awards and...
Series eight, am I right in thinking?
Yeah. I went on Loose Women talking about it. You know, it was number one in the relationship charts. And I just think the thing about it is there wasn't anything out there that I could find.
Yeah.
That talked honestly to me about what you'd feel and what you'd go through and shared other experiences. I felt like there was a lot of like experts advising you what to do, which is great. And you also need that. But I just wanted to like, just have an honest chat about it.
Like the real talk.
Yeah. Like, you know, like you would with your friend over a glass of wine.
Yeah.
And they just give you the lowdown on what happened. And I didn't want it to be like slating the ex. I just wanted it to be like, people's experience of that recovery bit, because that's the hard bit that we all have to get through.
You know, it was a similar thing when I decided to do the capsule as a podcast was for about women's mental health. That was an area that I was really struggling with. And I was like, I just need to talk to somebody like me that's like, that I can have that chat with, as you said, like a friend. And we can both talk about it really frankly. And then you feel like you're not alone and that you're not the kind of the weirdo in the group. That actually, once you open that can of worms and you open it up, that conversation, you'll find like somebody else going, oh my God, that's me. And it's that's me. And you need that connection for the healing process, I think, that allows you to feel normal, so to speak, you know, and kind of, you know, with some of the episodes that I've listened to of yours, and you do talk to men and women and non-binary people, it's the grieving process, I think, the grieving of the past life, the grieving of you, and then the healing of you. And, you know, for you, how did you kind of pick yourself up and move forward? And, you know, as we said right at the beginning, it was something that really kind of knocked your confidence and self-worth. What steps did you take?
Yeah, I think weirdly, it was the marriage that knocked my confidence and self-worth rather than the divorce.
Yeah.
I feel like the divorce was like the reawakening of like, oh, I'm a human that is quite nice. And other people can see that I'm quite nice and that's nice. So yeah, it was definitely a process. I feel like the podcast has helped me so much in my recovery, just talking to other people and learning from them and hearing different experiences. And, you know, I'm still learning. I'm like quite a few years on now and I'm in a new relationship, which comes with its own excitement and challenges. But I feel like I'm still learning from people about the process. And it's funny. I spoke to someone about divorce and the podcast, and, you know, it was a businessy person. And they were like, people probably only going to listen to your podcast like when they're just getting divorced, when they're in the midst of it, because then afterwards, like, it's over. And I think that's really funny, because it's never over. Yeah. It's a part of you forever, you know, and it comes in waves. And you might be 10 years on, 20 years on, 30 years on. You might be three marriages down the line, and all of a sudden you feel something about your first marriage. And so I think the whole process of it is really interesting. For me, I threw myself into work because, yeah, like, we literally had the conversation. He left. I then had a week of like crying, and my sister came to stay, and I didn't shower for like 4 days. And then she was like, Sam, I think we've got to the point now where I need to tell you, you stink. You must wash your body. And that's why relatives are really useful, close friends at that time. But then I was straight into rehearsals for Magic Mike Live, and then into an 18-month run in the West End. So for me, like, work and just having some structure and just going and doing something that wasn't about my divorce was really useful. But then it definitely got to the point where I had to take some time out and just recalibrate and almost like go on a holiday from normal work mode, which again is, I'm very privileged to have been able to do that. But, you know, even if it's just like a day or 2 days of just having nothing, where you just look after yourself and you can do whatever you want, and there's no one else telling you that you can't eat this or you shouldn't do that because in 2 weeks we're doing this, you know, just taking that time to look after yourself and love yourself a bit, and treat yourself like a friend would treat you. If they really, you know, if you were really struggling and you called over a friend that absolutely loved you, what are all the things, or reverse it, you know, what would you do for your friend? What are all the things you would do to show them that they're loved and needed, and how would you look after them and hold them? And I think taking that time is so important.
It's funny because, like, I've not been through my own divorce, but my mum and my stepdad separated and then went on to divorce. But the separation itself was when I was 21. And the impact that that had on me, as well as my mum, obviously my mum, bless her, it really completely kind of blindsided her, and she did not see any of it coming. And us as a family unit, we didn't see it coming. And I would have to say, as a daughter, I grieved that separation for probably about 10 years. It really, really, like, was such a huge, my whole existence had changed, and it was kind of out of my hands. And so, you know, for my mum, I think I was going through a very similar experience, in the sense that this had happened, this death of the marriage had happened, and it was very difficult. But as one of your other guests, I think it was Judy Jew, said, you know, you kind of need that moment where busyness, because dead time in your head allows you to then wander and then go into a cycle of like of a depression almost. And I definitely think that that's something that I experienced in my early 20s, even though, like I say, it wasn't my personal divorce, just the marriage breakdown itself. And for people, you know, picking themselves back up and moving forward, and obviously taking the time to care. But I think there's an element where you have to laugh and find funny as well. Like, you have to kind of find the humor to move forward and to, you know, obviously we hear about people having divorce parties, and, you know, in lots of ways, I'm an advocate of that. I'm thinking, yeah, well, actually, because you don't know why somebody's marriage has ended. Sometimes it's once somebody wants to end the marriage, or sometimes it's not. And, you know, and as you said, the marriage itself was probably more damaging to you than the divorce. Am I right in thinking that the funny sometimes is the way you do need to go with your friends and family?
Yeah, totally. I mean, there's definitely times for lying face down on the floor and crying in the kitchen, which I did. But there's also, you know, there is this sense of freedom that comes, you know, however your divorce started. And obviously some people do feel that it's a shock and they didn't know that it was going to happen. But at some stage, I think everyone gets to the stage. It might be at the beginning, or if, you know, if you decided, or it might be further down the line, where suddenly you're like, I'm free. And you stop, well, for a minute, you stop the discourse of I'm alone and start the discourse of I'm free, though, because it's just me. I can do anything I want to do. I can have cake for dinner and no one will moan at me, or I can leave my pants on the floor of the bathroom. But equally, I can like change jobs because I don't have to support that other person that used to be in my life. Or I can, you know, so I came out as bisexual after my divorce. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, I can come out and I can date women and see what that's like, which had been something that I'd obviously felt but never done because I was in a committed relationship. So, you know, there is this sense of freedom, a new chapter, a new you that is really exciting and fun and will make you laugh and be happy and joyous. And you might go a little bit wild for a bit, as I did. I call it my sexual explosion. You know, I don't mean to say that I'm a cliche of a divorced woman. And also, what is that cliche? I had sex with a lot of people and I had a glorious time, and it was all consensual and safe sex. And I'm not doing that now, but I'm so glad I did it because I learned so much about me. You know, you're having sex with the same person for a long time. And, you know, you might have, whatever you did in your sex life with that person, experimented or done new things. But then all of a sudden you get to have new sexual experiences. And to begin with, that is so terrifying. Mm. But then if you, you know, get to find a safe place with it, or, you know, doing therapy as well helped me so much. It was so important. And, you know, there's sex help, there's sex therapists and sex coaches that you can work through stuff with as well before you go into this stage if you feel like you need that. And even just that kind of experimentation, and like, and that doesn't mean like you have to go extreme if you don't want to. You know, an experimentation might just be like, I'm going to leave the light on, whereas you've always had sex with the light off. You know, it could be anything. But that stage is quite exciting and fun and full of joy. I remember I started the podcast and I was like, oh, divorce party? No. And then I spoke to Layla Hussein on the podcast, who had a divorce party, and she totally convinced me that it was amazing, because you have parties at every sort of new marker of your mm-hmm. life, like birthdays, Christmas, you have a party for your wedding, for your graduation, for all of those things.
I mean, you also have a wake. Do you know what I mean? And a lot of the time, like when people have the wake, a funeral, that's the time that they're able to properly move on. When they've grieved that person, celebrated that person in whatever capacity, and then they move on. So I suppose in a lot of ways, like you've just said, it kind of makes sense to do that.
Yeah, I mean, some people invite their ex to their divorce party, whereas other people...
That I'd not heard of.
No, there was one woman who got a... blacksmith to crush her wedding ring with like a blacksmith's hammer tool, and then gave her crushed wedding ring. You know, whatever works for you is fine. But just, I think, marking the occasion, because when I got my divorce, because you get, well, it the divorce procedures change now in the law, which is mm-hmm. I think a good thing. But You get the sort of first stage certificate of like, you're nearly divorced, but not quite. And then you get your final divorce certificate. And I always say, I wanted it to be like, you know, the national postcode lottery, where they turn up at your door, like a celebrity turns up at your door in an outfit and they hand you like a massive check. But instead they'd hand me like a massive divorce certificate, and maybe there'd be a confetti cannon and I'd be like on telly, and then there'd be a photo op. Like, I wanted it to be like that, but it wasn't. It was an attachment to an email. And so it feels really like this has been a journey. Like, just the legal proceedings are a journey. Mm-hmm. And all that I've got to show for it now is an attachment to an email. So you have to do something to mark the occasion, because it feels, I was speaking to someone who listened to the podcast, who got their final divorce certificate through the other day and were feeling all the emotions, because we have a Patreon account with like a chat group, and so everyone can write in there, and she was really feeling all the emotions. And you do, because you're like sad because it's over, and that, you know, that's a full stop now, and you know, maybe you still miss that person, or that you're still connected to them through children or whatever it is. And then you also feel like, oh, feel like it's done. Finally, I can start moving on like properly, or, you know, whatever it might be. So yeah, marking it is super important. So what I did, because mine came through, I think we were in a, like another lockdown.
Oh, gosh.
So it's still in that whole area. What I did was I dressed up. So I put makeup on, I put sequin, I put a really pretty dress on that like showed off my boobs, and I put a sequin shawl on. And then I like did a photo shoot for myself in my spare room, yes, and then like shared it on social media, and then like got my favorite takeaway to celebrate because I couldn't see anyone. So yeah, whatever it is, you definitely have to do something.
That sounds amazing. Definitely amazing. And you need to do a book. This is the next thing for you. Another book. And the protagonist is getting divorced.
Oh my God. Let me write this one first.
Yeah. I'll let you get this one done, but that's the next thing.
Okay.
Thank you so, so much for your time and for sharing your story and for sharing all of the other elements of your amazing career and all the work that you're doing as well.
Thank you.
If you'd like to get involved with Sam, then you can follow her on Twitter and Instagram at Samantha Baines. The Divorce Social podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. Plus, you can also visit the website www.thedivorcesocial.com for extra content on there. And don't forget, Samantha's book, Living with Hearing Loss and Deafness, is scheduled for release on the 27th of April, 2023. You can pre-order, so get online now and get those pre-orders in. For more well-being, fashion and beauty, you can visit us at our website, www.thecapsule.co.uk. You can also catch up with our previous podcast episodes by visiting the In Conversation page or subscribing to any of our podcast channels and YouTube. As always, feel free to leave your rates and reviews. I do love hearing from you. You can also drop us a message at Official Capsule on Instagram. I will be back next week with another very special guest. But all that's left for us to say today is goodbye. So it's goodbye from Sam.
Bye.
And goodbye from me. Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that episode. I absolutely loved it. And to be honest, we had to cut quite a lot of it down. I was chatting to Sam for so long, and we just couldn't run over and over and over. There were so many great bits in there. So we have given you the best bits. It was such a brilliant conversation. It was fantastic to hear about Sam's comedy roots, her acting roots, and also obviously her diagnosis of being deaf. She's an incredible woman, and the work that she's doing for the deaf community is amazing, really. And as she was saying, you know, more representation is needed. And I just think that it was a real eye-opener to hear kind of her experience with anxiety as well, and how her deafness potentially could be linked to her anxiety, and the fact that she's been working, her body has been working so hard to help her hear and understand and make conversation with people, and also that stimulation overload. I thought it was really, really interesting to hear that and to hear her talk about that so honestly. I also obviously loved the chat about divorce, and that was one of the reasons I wanted to chat to Sam, is because it's an area that we've not really covered before, divorce on the podcast, and quite a huge topic really, and something that I think we'll probably look into again next year. But it was fantastic to hear Sam's take on that and other people's experience of divorce too, because, you know, not everyone's experience is the same. As I mentioned in the chat, I've not had my own personal divorce, but from a family point of view, it was something that massively affected me for many years. And, you know, watching my mum have to go through that was very difficult. And I know there'll be lots of you that really resonate with that part of the chat. And how to find yourself and how to kind of grieve a past life. You know, there was a whole section in there about grief that was really interesting, and how, you know, divorce is kind of like the death of a relationship. But equally, how if you're in a terrible relationship or a destructive relationship, how once that has ended, you have a newfound freedom and you can be the person that you always wanted to be and you can celebrate it. You know, the idea of a divorce party. I think that's a great idea, definitely a great idea, because again, it gives you closure. It gives you that idea of, right, that chapter's closed now, just like you would with a wake at a funeral. That chapter's closed. We were able to celebrate or take away memories in whatever capacity, and move forward with life. So I found that really interesting. And the humour, you know, we can't forget the humour. We do have to laugh through the tears. You know, life's really, really tough. And if we don't find humour in it, then it's a bit of a struggle. So the fact that, you know, we can come together and share stories and laugh about experiences together and cry together, it's such a huge empowering thing. So definitely go and listen to Sam's podcast. And also let me know kind of how you're, if you're enjoying this series as well, and if you've had any major takeaways yourself. You know, don't forget, you can drop us a message at Official Capsule on Instagram. It would be great to see your rates, your reviews. I love reading them. We've had some new ones just recently, which have been really lovely to read and really encouraging for us over here, kind of putting everything together, because we want to make sure that what we're doing is good and that you're enjoying it. So definitely keep leaving those rates and reviews and tell us what you're interested in. Tell us what you want more of, and we will do our very best to make sure that, you know, we provide that for you. Anyways, I hope you have a lovely rest of your day, and we will be back next week with another very special guest, as I always say. But yeah, we've got some really great guests coming up for the rest of the series. I can't believe like we're near the end already. It goes so fast, really, really fast. Anyway, yeah, have you all got your Christmas decorations up yet? I think I'm going to put mine up. Anyway, speak soon. Bye-bye.
This episode of The Capsule in Conversation was brought to you by Harrogate Springwater. Bottled at source, Harrogate Spring offers a pure, refreshing taste with a delicate blend of naturally occurring minerals and electrolytes, perfect for healthy hydration.